Blog Talk Radio.
I can't believe it, you mean. All I had to do was ask. I can't believe it, life is.
Hi, this is XBN, the Swap East Broadcast Network, powered by Blog Talk Radio out of Raleigh, Durham. This is Amanda Brooks filling in for our regular host, Joel Brenneman. Today we have a very special guest, Susan Lopez, who is a co-founder of the Desiree Alliance. The Desiree Alliance is a sex worker organization, but it doesn't necessarily pursue an agenda. Instead, it serves to network and bring together various sex worker organizations within the U.S. We should have Susan joining us shortly for an interview. She's going to talk about founding Desiree Alliance and the upcoming Desiree Alliance conference in 2008 in July in Chicago. I'm going to be there. Jill will be there. Susan obviously will be there, and so will a lot of other people. I attended the 2007 conference in San Francisco, and it was just a wonderful experience with a mix of informative presentations, academic presentations, and presentations from the personal side of sex work. Desiree Alliance is a very inclusive organization, so pretty much any sex worker of any type is welcome to contact them and learn how to contribute to Desiree Alliance specifically, or get in contact with the network of sex worker organizations that the Desiree Alliance has contact with. So I am waiting on Susan right now. I guess my introduction was shorter than I expected it to be. So she is not on yet. Okay, I will play a short bit of music until she calls in.
Chapter, please. I could be the character. I could hold the key. The sun don't shine in this here chapter. This chapter takes place in the middle of the night with no comfortable.
Hello. Hey, are you?
Hello.
Hey.
Hey, okay. It's me, Susan.
Yes, I introduced you, and we're definitely ready to go. I described Desiree Alliance with a sentence or two saying that it doesn't necessarily follow a particular agenda, but it serves to network other sex worker organizations within the U.S. So tell us a bit more about Desiree Alliance and its mission.
Well, Desiree Alliance is an organization that seeks to provide a safe space for sex workers to be able to communicate with each other and to network, as you said, and we try and foster leadership within the movement. There was a leadership conference held last October in D.C. Specifically for this purpose. It was very well attended, and a lot of the leaders from the conference this year came from that conference or teach-in or whatever you want to call it.
When you talk about leadership, what do you mean? What do you expect out of leaders? What's the goal? What do you mean by leadership?
By leadership, we mean people who want to take responsibility in the movement for pushing forth a lot of the issues that we're working on. Specifically, this year it's going to be the conference that will be in Chicago in July. And the leadership roles that people are taking are, people who are going to be working on the conference in different aspects, in different roles. Anything from putting together a program to approving call for submissions to organizing the schedule, organizing, food, lodging,
yeah,
et cetera, et cetera.
So the conference is Desiree Alliance's main focus right now, but what about the rest of the year? What other focuses does Desiree Alliance have?
We do a lot of work towards assisting people in getting words out. For instance, different projects around the United States are doing their own activism. They take on different causes. And so we serve kind of in a capacity of, in our networking capacity to alert all of the groups that are members of Desiree Alliance and others that these different issues are going on around the country. There's a current push right now to decriminalize in Hawaii, and they submitted some legislation last year for review, and so we help in terms of getting the word out to give phone calls to senators and to anybody who knew anybody in Hawaii to get their constituents to call in and discuss these things with their representatives to try and help push this forward. Unfortunately, that legislation hasn't yet gone to the floor for discussion, but we're hoping that that will happen this year. So different things that people are doing around the country, we try and promulgate. Desiree Alliance is largely made up of the SWAP chapters around the U.S., SWAP East, being one of them, of course. And then we have SWAP Las Vegas, SWAP Michigan, SWAP Texas, SWAP Las Vegas, SWAP NorCal, SWAP UCLA and Los Angeles, and I'm probably missing one. SWAP Chicago.
Arizona.
SWAP Arizona. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, so the Desiree Alliance mainly serves as an overall networking tool for sex worker organizations, basically.
Absolutely, absolutely.
And how did you, you're one of the co-founders, so how did you come up with this idea to form this organization?
Well, it was an interesting process. I was in London at London School of Economics doing my master's thesis on sex worker organizing around the world, particularly in developing countries. And but I was interested to know that there were all these pieces of a sex workers' rights movement going on in the U.S., but nothing consistent across the board. And the part of the puzzle that I found online that was current and something that was going on currently at that time, which is in 2004, August of 2004, I found Robin Few's effort in San Francisco and in the Bay Area, actually in Berkeley specifically, to decriminalize prostitution. It was something called Measure Q. And I had done my undergraduate degree at Berkeley, and I contacted her and I said, hey, I would love to set something up at the university, like a debate or a panel or something where we could, you know, discuss the benefits of Measure Q. And so she got back to me and gave me Avrin Ipsen's number or email address. And I contacted Avrin, and she and I, because she also has connections to Berkeley. She is doing her, or she finished her PhD there now, but at the time she was working on her PhD. So I got in touch with her, and we arranged to have this debate on Measure Q and at the university. And for that debate, we had Melissa Farley and Norma Hotelling on the panel against Measure Q. And there was also this woman named Davida Cody. And on the pro side, we had Robin Few, Veronica Monet, and Laura Augustine. And that was an interesting panel, because that will never happen again, I have a feeling.
Unfortunately.
Yeah, and the only reason I think I got away with getting all those people together is because nobody knew who the heck I was. I was just some innocent student from London School of Economics or something. Oh, okay. And, but it was interesting. It was an interesting panel. But right after that, literally about 3 days later, I was at a conference in Toledo, Ohio at University of Toledo. Mm-hmm. And Robin Few was also at that conference, as was Norma Jean Almodovar, Carol Lee, and Penny Saunders, and a few other people. And so this was my introduction to pretty much everybody in the current sex workers' rights movement at that time, which was mostly focused in California, but there were bits and pieces around. And at that conference, we got together on the last day. We all got together for breakfast. And we agreed that we should do something, you know, from the sex workers themselves rather than about sexers, you know, sex workers talking, you know, for themselves at a conference of some sort. We brought all kinds of ideas up, like a camp, a summer camp, and all these different organizing ideas. But the one thing that stuck among us was, you know, to do an actual conference somewhere. And I said, oh, let's do Las Vegas. And that everybody kind of liked that idea. And then once everybody left that, we kind of all kept in touch. And then I was introduced to Stacy Swim. And Stacy Swim also had these ideas. And she's very a very energetic activist and extremely intelligent. And so together we kind of pushed for this idea. And then she submitted all the paperwork, a nonprofit. We have a nonprofit sponsor, and she submitted all the paperwork to put that through and came up with the name Desiree Alliance, and so that's what we did.
Great. That's a great story. It's, yeah, I haven't heard that before, so I really enjoyed it. I mean, you managed to get together some high-powered people. That's impressive.
Well, it was very serendipitous. I think it was time. I think that's the only reason that it worked out, is that it was definitely time to happen. You know, from my perspective, I had been working on this academically since my undergraduate degree, and I started working on issues in Thailand and Bangkok, you know, the women who perform in the shows there, just fascinated by it. And having been to Thailand several times, I decided I wanted to do a paper on it, and I kept reading all of these things that just weren't consistent with my experience in the sex industry, nor my experience with the women in Thailand or anybody else in the sex industry. And that's when I discovered this split in ideology in terms of people who are sex workers saying, hey, this is what we do, you know, it's a job, respect our rights and allow us, you know, to pursue justice when wrongs are committed against us. And then the other side is saying, you know, oh, they're all victims, they can't speak for themselves and they don't know what they're doing, and you know, we need to save them all. And so that wasn't gelling with my experience. And So that's how I got involved in looking at the issues further. And the thing that stuck out for me back then when I was at Berkeley was the fact that there was not really a current movement. I read all this amazing stuff about all this wonderful stuff that had happened in the 80s with Margot St. James and the founding of Coyote and all of the things that they did. And they had the two World Wars Congresses. And but there was just nothing current going on in the U.S. And so it's kind of like, where is everybody? What's going on? There's got to be something out there. And it wasn't until I found Robin Few that I found something. So I would definitely credit Robin Few with the start of the new,
she's
the start
amazing.
Of the new movement. Yeah, she really is. She's got a lot of energy, a lot of charisma.
Hang on for just a second. I need to take a station break to remind listeners. This is XBN, the Swap East Broadcast Network, powered by Blog Talk Radio. I am interviewing Susan Lopez, who is one of the co-founders of Desiree Alliance. You can visit them online at DesireeAlliance.org. That's D-E-S-I-R-R-E-E, Alliance.org. And you can also call in 646-200-3136. And, did we just lose Susan? Crap, what happened? Okay. There we go. There we go.
I lost you.
Yeah, I panicked. Okay, done with the announcing, and I wanted to go in. Actually, before we go into talking about the upcoming conference and the last two conferences, I wanted to go off on a tangent here real quickly because you were talking about the bar girls in Bangkok and Thailand. And I had just read this really hideous book called Hello, My Big, Big Honey. It's a collection of letters from men who are in love with these Thai bar girls. And and some of the letters the girls
You said it was hideous. I loved it.
I thought the men were just awful. I really did. They were so unrealistic.
They were. But you know what? It didn't surprise me because of my time down there and watching this all happen.
I love the interviews with the girls, but the perspectives of the writers is what I really had a problem with.
You have to take that for what it's worth.
Yes. So,
it was definitely from a client's perspective.
Yeah. I can say that. So I'm wondering, though, since you're talking about researching sex work down there, and I don't know if you'd ever, danced in a bar there or not, I wanted to know how your perspective differs from the usual perspective of the sex workers in Thailand, whether they're bar girls or, sex workers, escorts, whatever. I wanted to know more about your perceptions versus the common perceptions?
Well, the common perception, I didn't know any perception when I was there in Thailand. I've been to Thailand probably about 5 times, and every single time I went, I absolutely made it a point to go to Patthong Road to see what I call vaginal acrobatics, because these women perform amazing feats with their vaginal muscles. And I was always fascinated by them, and I would sit down with them, and I would buy them drinks, and I would talk to them and find out more about their lives. And, being a dancer myself, I was ultra aware of the tipping thing, so I would tip them as I sat and talked to them because I knew they were taking time out of earning money to talk to me. And, they were just regular people doing their jobs. Pretty much, the thing that I got out of it. And then when I started to research this, I kept coming up with, I did a lot of online research, and the online research I kept coming up with was put out by the CATW, Coalition Against Trafficking in Women. And, they kept saying, they're all sold when they're 5 into the sex industry, they're all sex slaves, blah, 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 blah. And I just kind of, you know, it didn't match my perception. And I was willing to give that here I was a Westerner in these bars in Thailand. And so I wasn't necessarily, you know, going to get the full-on real picture. But at the same time, having worked in the industry for 15 years, I kind of had an inkling about what it might be. You kind of get a sense of integrity, I guess I would say, integrity and purpose and whatnot. And I never got any of that from these women. And so in my further studies of it, I did discover that there were indeed women who were enslaved in the sex industry. But typically, these were women who had come in from Cambodia and Burma to work, Myanmar. And these women were taken advantage of because they were immigrants, and they were more easily coerced into a situation that they didn't have much control over. And they, some of them do end up in these tea houses in a place called Yawarat. It's a Chinatown, and it's there are all these tea houses, and I remember seeing the tea houses and wondering, you know, do they serve tea there? There were just so many of them. But apparently in the basements, they actually do have brothels where women can be chained to beds. And the women in those situations largely serve the local population. And the people who control these women typically charge about 50 cents per transaction. And women who work in Bangkok on Patpong Road will, you know, earn much more than that. And so the goal of every woman coming to Bangkok to work is to work in a place like Patpong Road where they can make up to $800 a month, as opposed to their, at the time I was studying this, I think it was in 2002, something like that, the minimum wage was about $59.45 per month. And these women could earn up to $800 a month working in the bars in Patpong Road. You know, contrast that with, you know, what the locals can afford and what the locals will pay. You can see that there is a market for a situation where people have access to the cheaper experiences, for lack of a better word. And while these tea house situations are very rare, they absolutely, completely, 100% different from what's going on in Patpong Road. So that was kind of interesting for me. Also, the
so
women
it's definitely
who work,
like two different worlds there, right in the same city.
Absolutely. And not all of the women who work on Patpong Road are from Bangkok. Most of them are from the rural areas of Bangkok. I'm sorry, the rural areas of Thailand in the north and the northeast. But not all of them. Some of the immigrants who come through do manage to make it to Patpong Road and are able to make a decent living and send their money back to their families. Now, the interesting thing is that the women who work in the on the bars in Bangkok, they average per year, and again, this was back in 2002, so it's probably a lot different now. I would imagine more now. But back then, they would average, they would send home to their villages over $800 million a year collectively. And
wow.
That kind of money went, you know, that was more than any government grant, any agricultural loan, anything that they could get in the rural area. So a lot of the development that happens out there happened because these women send the money home. And so you'll get this phenomenon of these little villages made with these bamboo huts. You know, consisting of bamboo huts, and then inside the bamboo huts are these really fancy refrigerators that are bought with the money that these women, you know, bring home. It's just fascinating. And they'll buy tractors for their family to work the land. They'll buy fertilizer. They'll buy motorcycles for their, you know, for their families to use.
Wow.
So,
that's definitely a different picture than, you know, we normally get in America.
Yeah, it is. And it's a shame that this doesn't get out because it's fascinating to me. It's absolutely fascinating. And the women are considered heroes when they come home to the villages. You know, they're dressed in city clothing and they're wearing makeup and jewelry and this, that, and the other. And And when they come back, they're treated like movie stars. And it's interesting that in the village, the attitude towards this, you know, when an interviewer would ask, you know, some of the village people, you know, the parents of these women who went into the city, when they would ask them what their daughters did they know what their daughters did? They would often say, "Oh yes, she's a hostess at a bar," or "she works at a salon," or you know, and it's like the whole village has this kind of nudge, like everybody knows in reality what's going on, but everybody agrees that they're hostessing. It's like nobody really wants to say exactly what's going on. It's not, you know, it's just kind of like everybody agrees that, you know, that's something that's got to be done. But nobody names it. So it's very
interesting. That's kind of a human thing. They stick together in their communities
mm-hmm.
and families.
Mm-hmm.
So absolutely. I'm going to just announce again real quick. I hope I don't lose you. This is XBN Hoppy's Broadcast Network, powered by Blog Talk Radio. And this is Amanda Brooks filling in for Jill Brenneman. I am interviewing Susan Lopez, one of the co-founders of Desiree Alliance. You can find their website online, DesireeAlliance.org. That's DesireeE. And you can also call in 646-200-3136. And so back to Susan, let's talk about the upcoming convention this July in Chicago. Tell us about the new Desiree Alliance conference this year and why you're excited.
Well, I'm excited because I think we're going to have a bigger turnout this year than ever. There are many, many more communities who are in you know, connected and networked to this event. So there are a lot more people out there that are talking about coming. I've spoken to people in very disparate areas of the industry who are interested who were interested in submitting proposals for workshops. We've just managed to develop an incredible network. We have over 140 people on our Desiree Alliance listserv, people who are interested in coming and keeping updated with the events that are going on. And I think this is going to be a bigger conference than we've had before. It's also going to be a more I don't know what the world is, but I think there are going to be a lot more people who are going to be interested in this. And I think the diversity is going to be incredible this time as well. Our diversity for our first conference was very good. The second conference was okay. But this conference, I think, you know, they're especially working on having, you know, a lot of representative people from different parts of the community. So I think it's going to be very exciting.
Great. Wanted to know, how many people do you think will attend this conference? Do you have any idea?
I really couldn't tell you because I'm not intricately involved with the nuts and bolts of this conference. I'm going to be the last one almost entirely by myself, so this one I'm kind of going to enjoy rather than worry about the details. But I do know that again, we've already got over 143, I think, that last look on our listserv. And so, you know, that's a good sign. This is the day before the conference. And we always show a lot more people that are interested, you know, come the time of the conference. Mm-hmm. So that's a very good sign.
Well, I was going to ask, is the listserv for the public? Can anybody listening to this join the listserv to get updates?
Pretty much. It's open to anybody who's interested in attending the conference. We do minimally screen, so if people would like to join the listserv, again, it's announcement only. It's not a discussion listserv, but there is a discussion one that you'll be invited to once you've joined that. Write a note and let us know who you are and why you want to join the listserv. So we don't write nothing because we won't admit you if you write nothing. So write something.
Yes. Are there public, is this all for sex workers only, or is the conference open to the general public as well?
not really open to the general public. It really is a kind of it's a security. Obviously, there's some security risks with a conference like this, so we're being very judicious as to who we register and who we allow access to the conference. So in terms of just popping up and saying, I'm Joe Blow from down the street and I'd like to go to this conference, that probably won't work. But if somebody, when they register for the conference, if they were, you know, able to explain how they found out about it, why they want to go, and, you know, give enough information to let us know that they don't mean anybody any harm and they're not going to harass anybody there, then they would be more than welcome, I'm sure.
So probably the best suggestion would be to join the listserv and then...
Join the listserv, absolutely. Yes. And if they're interested, they could try. They can register. I think registration is open. So you just go to the website and click on the conference button, and all the information should be there, including the link to join the listserv.
Yes, it is there. I'm looking at it right now. So tell us about the theme of the conference, Pulling Back the Sheet, Sex, Work, and Social Justice.
Well, this theme is basically about, you know, the rights of people who work in the industry, as it seems to be a theme through all of our conferences, whether it's about decriminalization or the culture of sex work or not. So this is an interesting, the title of the conference was actually quite controversial among a lot of the people who were involved in naming the conference, but we settled on that because it's a sexy title, it's an intriguing title, and it makes people want to know more about it. So yeah, it would definitely have to do with the rights of sex workers and social justice for sex workers.
Do you think that this is... becoming very timely with the Spitzer scandal and the DC Madam trial, which is supposed to begin this month?
Oh, absolutely. I think it's, you know, I think things are kind of reaching a crescendo. There's so much going on, all the different things, you know, the teams going through the news and everybody jumping on the, you know, the escort bandwagon, so to speak. There's so much media attention to these things and all of the agency busts and everything that have been happening. It's really interesting it's an interesting time, and I think as it is reaching a crescendo, this is it's a good time, and it's a scary time, too. People are terrified. You know, a lot of women have gone underground. They're, you know, under the radar. They don't want to... Too many people have been contacted by the media, and people are getting... scared and scattering, and so that's kind of challenging as well, because the less, you know, the more attention the industry gets from the media, the less available people want to be for not only speaking to the media, but for, you know, being available as activists in the movement. People don't want to put their heads above water, so to speak. And
so
having light
on them. Oh, yeah, I can't blame them. I wanted to know what your predictions are, given how suddenly the spotlight has been turned on sex work in the U.S. over the past year. What are your predictions for the upcoming year as far as, legal matters? How is that going to fall out? Do you have any predictions for what might happen?
Well, there are a couple things happening. I think the disconcerting thing for me is that the people who get the attention, the money, and the ear of public officials are the people who are, for lack of a better word, zealots in terms of, you know, elimination of the sex industry altogether. And they have, they're the most well-funded, and they have a lot of pull and clout and influence over the current administration and other public officials. But the good thing is that with the spotlight on the industry, people are starting to see that people like Kristen, you know, Spitzer's escort, are clearly not victims. You know, I think the zealots really rely on this idea that all women are trafficked into prostitution and blah, 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 blah. But I think that this proves that this is not necessarily the case. And I mean, nobody would look at Kristen and think that she's trafficked, and nobody would look at Spitzer and think that he's a trafficker. A scoundrel, yes, but not a trafficker. So,
mm-hmm.
So I think on the one hand, that's going to be very good for us because people are going to start, you know, it's opened up a dialogue that needs to happen. Because let's face it, this it's existence, it's there. You know, let's make it safe. Let's, you know, make it so that people involved can address wrongs that are committed to them, you know, against them. You know, when I was studying the industry in Thailand and around the rest of the world, the overwhelming theme that I got from all of my studies and, you know, organizations in Thailand and in India and Tolkort, Cambodia, in Myanmar, Burma, you know, and all of these places, Taiwan, China, South America, everywhere, the overwhelming theme is that everybody's afraid of the authority figures, you know, whether they be the police officers or, you know, any other government officials, because they are often taken advantage of by these people who are supposed to protect the public. And but it's interesting how often, you know, sex workers don't merit the same rights as the rest of the citizenship.
Are these all countries where sex work is criminalized?
No, I mean, yeah, well, for the most part, but even under so-called legal status, you know, it's very, very ambiguous in terms of exactly the legal status of actual sex workers. Perhaps the actual exchange of sex for money is legal, but everything surrounding it is illegal, so it in effect makes her a criminal
mm-hmm.
by default.
So what about, say, Australia and New Zealand? Have you gotten to visit those countries and see their systems?
Well, I was in both Australia and New Zealand back in 1998. And it was before it was decriminalized in New Zealand. It was decriminalized in 2000 in New Zealand. But it was legal. It was legal. You know, ostensibly legal. Now, you know, I really don't know now going back because I worked at a strip club there in Auckland, and on the main floor was the strip club I worked at where women danced for men. In the basement downstairs was a club where men danced for women, and on the very top floor, the second floor of the building, was a brothel, and it was just this big playhouse. And people just talked about it. Yeah, you know, it was no big deal. I think it might have been legal but not decriminalized. There were probably a lot of regulations and whatnot. So I don't really remember I don't know what the legal status was. I presumed it was legal because of the existence of the brothel and nobody seemed to have anything to say about it. So I think that was pretty legal, especially if it was, the club was just glamorous, so I can't imagine that they would have, like, an illegal operation going on upstairs. So, but under a legalized system, you know, there are all these really bizarre things that happen, like the laws against profiting off of the work of the immoral earnings, you know, the immoral work of prostitutes, profiting off of these. And these laws have been, you know, used in many cases to prosecute the partners of sex workers, and overwhelmingly these partners are of a different, you know, often, you know, brown people or immigrants or what have you, and that, so that's kind of, you know, an awful situation where they, and the other thing is that there was a case in France, I believe, where somebody who was a mortgage lender actually was prosecuted for giving a mortgage to a prostitute because they were making immoral earnings. You know, they were making a living off of immoral earnings. You know, hotel owners.
Uh-oh. Hello? I think we lost Susan again. Hello? Okay. Hello? Oh, shoot. Okay, we lost Susan.
Hello?
Okay, there we go. There we go.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Can you hear me? Okay, great.
Yeah. You were talking about the case in France where the mortgage lender got prosecuted, and then you started discussing hotel owners.
Yeah, some hotel owners can be arrested under this, and also adult children of sex workers. If a prostitute gives her son, who's 17 years old, a brand new car for his birthday, then he can be arrested for living off immoral means, or just the fact that he lives in her house, you know, and he's an adult, considered an adult in certain societies at 17, then he can be gotten for living on, you know, off of immoral means.
Huh.
So even though the actual act itself is legal, clearly they're still persecuted. None of these laws exist, you know, for the sake of sex workers. They all exist to persecute sex workers.
So I'm going to ask, because I know because of the Switzer thing that the Swedish model is starting to be seriously considered in the U.S. What do you think about the Swedish model?
Oh, I think it's awful. I think it's infantilizing. It's insulting to women. I think that nobody should be criminalized for adult consensual sexual activity. You know, you hear this theme over and over again that, oh, it's not a victimless crime. You know, there are victims, the family of, you know, Spitzer's family and Kristen's family and this and that and the other. But you know what? Then you better make all adultery illegal, because there are the same victims if Spitzer were to have an affair with his secretary. You know, this is just ridiculous. So no, I think all adult sexual consensual activity should be decriminalized. And I mean, Spitzer's not a monster, for Christ's sakes. He's a hypocrite, and a lot of people have issues with him. I have issues with him, but he's by no means a trafficker or a monster. What we imagine is a sex offender or a sexual criminal. He's just a guy that wanted to get laid by somebody.
Yeah,
he's a politician. Exactly. And, you know, I think what's interesting is I think this is a wake-up call in a way for Americans to realize that these things go on. That not everybody is in a very, you know, and I think that people know this in their own lives, that nobody's, you know, saying that every marriage in the United States is perfectly, you know, unadulterated. You know, it's just unrealistic. And 50% of all marriages end in divorce. You know, how much of that is because the man had an affair, you know, with somebody, be it a paid companion or, you know, a secretary or the woman down the street, you know, and how many women are having sex with their pool boys. You know, it's just, I think it's a discussion that needs to happen in America. Our ideas about monogamy, fidelity, you know, what does marriage mean today? You know, are our expectations realistic? Can, you know, it's something that needs to be discussed. And I think it's a good thing. I think in a lot of relationships, this has sparked a debate, you know, between couples. It's sparked a debate, you know, in the public eye, you know, about a lot of things. And I think in a way it's good.
Yeah. Hang on 1 second. I need to do a quick station break, and then we'll be right back. This is XBN, the Swap East Broadcast Network, powered by Blog Talk Radio. And this is Amanda Brooks filling in for Jill Brenneman. I am interviewing Susan Lopez, co-founder of DesireeAlliance.org. You can find it online, DesireeAlliance.org, DesireeE. And we are discussing all things sex work and the Desiree Alliance Conference that is coming up this July in Chicago. So back to Susan. With the discussion, the thing that I am concerned about actually is the discussion in the United States over adopting the Swedish model, because a lot of these anti-trafficking and anti-prostitution zealots really love the Swedish model, and they're obviously pushing for it in the U.S. If that passes, what do you think is going to happen to sex workers? How do you think that's going to change things? How can sex...
Well, you know, I think that's going to be a difficult thing to do nationally, federally, number one, because prostitution is a state-by-state issue. You know, it's the state legislature that has the last word over whether or not it's illegal. And I live in Nevada, where we have the only legal system in the United States. So that's an interesting place to see. You know, it's never going to happen there. They've tried to do away with the brothels on numerous occasions. But, you know, the people in Nevada kind of have this very kind of Wild West attitude. You know, leave us alone. Let us run our own stuff. You know, keep your nose out of our business. We'll govern our state the way we want it governed. And most people vote down every time somebody wants to eliminate the brothels. People vote it down. You know, I'm not saying that prostitutes have a great time in these areas where they exist, where these brothels exist, because I you know, I hear that there is a lot of, you know, stigma, and the women get attitudes when they go to the local stores, et cetera, et cetera. There are even some areas where the prostitutes are not allowed to live in the same community that they work at the brothels. So there's still a lot of stigma, and there's still a lot of issues with it, but people aren't interested in eliminating them, which is a good thing for us.
Yes.
I think the Swedish model is still kind of a little bit of a pipe dream, although I do worry that somebody's going to slip it into some other legislation that gets passed federally, and then you're going to have a big can of worms, because you still have these issues with, you know, a state-by-state issue.
So do you think citizens in the U.S. are leaning more toward decriminalization or legalization, or do you think they still are happy just criminalizing all sex work?
I think by and large, it depends on region. I think it also depends on how much exposure people in certain communities have had to sex workers or the debate itself. In a lot of cases, you know, you have, well, the fact that, you know, the existence of Kristen and all of her friends at the Emperor's Club proves that, you know, not everybody is, you know, coerced into this, and not everybody's addicted to drugs or, you know, what have you, that there is a variety of expressions of the sex industry, of sex work. And so that's going to probably make people a little bit more aware of the fact that people can do this in a way that is not, you know, necessarily degrading or not what the zealots would have you believe. So I think that presents a challenge to the zealots. But
so,
I think by and large, people who think about it would definitely go for, if they understood the differences, they would go for decriminalization. When you talk to the average person on the street, they usually, when I talk to people, they say, oh, yeah, they should just legalize it and make it safer, and, you know, so the women can get checkups and this, that, and the other. So they automatically go to the public health aspect, which, again, is problematic, and I explain to them why that's problematic, but most people think it should be dealt with differently.
So I guess the real issue comes down to what you just said, which is people can't make better decisions when sex workers educate them on what the options are and what the option, you know, ramifications of the different options. So
exactly.
I guess it means sex worker activists need to really get the message out, if at all possible.
Absolutely, and I just noticed in my inbox today when I was looking at emails that there is something called sexwork101.com or .org. Do you remember getting that? It was on the Swap USA listserv.
Yeah. Let me.
I think Audacia Ray and the people from Spread Magazine developed this little website, kind of an educational thing for the public to learn about sex work, which I think is a brilliant idea.
Yeah, sexwork101.
And well past you. Sexwork101.com?
Uh-huh.
Yeah,
yeah.
So I think it's a really good idea, and I think that's going to be a step in that direction of educating the public about the differences and the nuances.
So But what can sex workers do for themselves, legally speaking, since they're still working in a system of criminalization? Or I should say sex worker activists. What can sex worker activists do?
Well, educate their friends in the industry as to exactly what's illegal and exactly what is legal. Escorting is not illegal. Exchanging sex acts for money is illegal in most areas, except in certain counties in Nevada and only in the brothels. Just be very safe. I hesitate to really go much further along those lines because I am not a lawyer. I can't give legal advice. But I would definitely say be familiar with exactly the letter of the law. And everyone who works in the sex industry should definitely have a lawyer that they have the number punched into their little cell phone so that if anything happens, they have access to that number immediately. Absolutely have to have a lawyer. And to do a Know Your Rights, workshop, or go online and get the book called Beat the Heat by Katya Kosara.
Yeah.
That's really important to do. So sex workers, activists in there, anybody who's inclined towards activism, who wants to get involved in this sort of thing, everybody is encouraged to open up a SWAP chapter in their area. There are instructions on how to do that on the swapusa.org website, swap-usa.org. You don't even have to call it SWAP if you want to. You can, in New York there are two. There's SWAP New York and there's SWANK, Sex Workers Action Network. Sex Workers Action New York. And SWAP New York is for anybody who's interested in the movement, and SWANK is just for sex workers and retired sex workers who do their own actions, but then they all have common meetings. So those are different ideas. And I would encourage anyone to get involved and start researching. Know what's out there. Know what's going on. Know what people are trying to do to sex workers.
Yeah.
Especially the zealots.
The thing that gets me the most, though, is that so often sex workers' voices in the media are squelched or distorted, where the zealots really get off easy, quite honestly. They're very free to express themselves, and sex workers generally are not. And to me, this is a big obstacle to changing public opinion and educating the public.
Oh, absolutely. And that's why there's been a surge of sex worker-run media, which is wonderful. You've got BattleNotGag.com. You've got the Chicago, I think it's a red light district or something like that. Kitty goes out and interviews people, and I think that's great. You've got Swappy, this radio show. You've got Squirrel, Sex Workers Internet Radio Lounge. There's a lot of sex worker-led media, which is good. There needs to be more. Is that noise in the background bothering you?
Oh, no, it's okay.
Oh, okay, because somebody ordered a blended drink in this restaurant that I'm at. There's a lot of sex worker-led media, but there needs to be more, and I think we need to liaise more with the mainstream media. One of the things that I think has been suggested on several occasions, at least among people that I know out in my area, is that somebody needs to write to the ombudsman of the New York Times and say, look, Bob Herbert and Melissa Farley and this crew have had their say about sex work, but we demand space to refute what they're saying. We as sex workers demand space to be able to set the record straight on our own lives, on what we think. They're talking about us. We demand to be able to have a word in there to address what they're saying about us.
I'm sorry. My phone punked out, and I just lost, the last minute. I am so sorry about that.
Where did you leave off?
You had just commented on the noise in the background, and then for whatever reason, my phone decided to give it up.
Oh, sorry. No, but what I was saying is that one of the things that had been suggested on my end of things out here in Vegas is that somebody should write to the, we should get together as a group and write to the Ombudsman of the New York Times and demand to get our voices heard, you know, because they publish all kinds of things from, you know, Bob Herbert and everybody else, but Melissa Farley and all of the zealots and whatnot, but nobody's publishing our viewpoint. And we need to get that heard, and so we should demand space for that in the New York Times because they've given ample space to the other side, and that's something we could, you know, conceivably do. So I think that needs to happen. But I think it is important that we liaise with mainstream media. We need to cultivate more media allies, which we have quite a few. I think since the Spitzer case, you know, there have been a lot of media people who have been interested in talking to us, which is different than it has been, you know, for a long time. It's definitely different than what happened under the Deborah Palfrey King case broke. And so I think that's really important to maintain those media contacts so that we can get our voices heard in mainstream media.
Yes. Oh, I totally agree. Completely. Yeah, I'm just curious, letting other people know, you know, where the sex activist movement is right now, basically.
Where geographically?
Oh, no.
Oh.
No, where metaphorically, I guess.
Yeah, where we stand. That's where we stand. And there's, again, there's still controversy. I was speaking to a couple of the women I know who are, you know, still working in the industry who are, I would call them peripheral activists because they're not really activists and they're not interested in being noticed or anybody paying any attention to them. But they do have, one of them has a serious issue with anybody talking, anybody shining a light on the middle part of the industry. And I speak about this in regards to the 2020 special. It's getting loud in here, sorry. But in regards to the 2020 special, do you remember that? It was with Diane Sawyer?
Yeah, I'm aware of it, yes.
Well, basically, she showed basically two sides of the industry, and the main crux of her entire show was about, you know, these very troubled young women who are in the industry, you know, drug addicted and on the streets and, the absolute worst case scenario to imagine. And she gave, you know, just a few minutes to somebody on a complete opposite end of the spectrum, the very, very, very high end of the spectrum. You know, very high class Manhattan call girl or whatever. And the reality is that most of the industry exists in between. But nobody from the middle part of the industry was interviewed for that show. She definitely stuck to the extremes, which was a little bit disconcerting to the sex workers' rights movement. But on the other hand, again, my friend who's in the industry doesn't really want a light show in the middle industry. She thinks bad to have any more attention because it's making it very difficult for people to work right now.
Yeah.
So I see her end too.
We have to wrap it up. I'm sorry that I dropped the call because that ate up some time. So I'm sorry about that. This is XBN, the Swap East Broadcast Network, powered by Blog Talk Radio out of Raleigh, Durham. And we have finished interviewing Susan Lopez, co-founder of Desiree Alliance. You can find out more at DesireeAlliance.org, DesireeE. And you can join us here tomorrow. You can join us here tomorrow as I interview Renegade Evolution. Want to say thank you to Susan for coming in and sharing so much with us.
Well, thank you for having me.
Thanks. It was great.
I hope to do it again sometime.
Oh, yeah, definitely. We will have to.
I'll see you at the conference.
Oh, have a good flight, by the way. This is not on air.
Thanks. I will.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye.